Italian food may be the most popular ethnic cuisine in the country, but it's been a long time since an Italian restaurant in New York has been ranked as highly as the top French eateries. That changed when Del Posto, the creation of Joe Bastianich and Mario Batali, received 4 stars from the New York Times 2 years ago. Mr. Bastianich has written a memoir called Restaurant Man about his culinary philosophy, the lessons passed on to him from his restaurant royalty parents, and his successes at Babbo Lupa and Del Posto, among others. Joe Bastianich was on our show to talk about his book, which was published by Viking this past May, and we are re-airing that interview for you. I began by asking him, you say the motto you use to run your businesses makes no mention of cuisine, that you and Mario Batali say, we buy things, we fix them up, and we sell things for profit. But isn't that true of every restaurant from McDonald's on up?
I think it's just about accentuating the fact that restaurants are art and hospitality, but before all that, you have to have profitability and commerce. And I always say commerce without margin is a hobby, and restaurants aren't a hobby. And I think that's why the failure rate is so high. So it's just kind of making a point that you have to make money.
And I was just Saturday, I was talking to some restaurateurs who are very socially conscious, and they talked about how difficult it is to keep their prices down, make a profit, and at the same time not do anything that's going to hurt the environment, it's going to help local farmers, et cetera, et cetera.
It certainly is the future of our business, you know, having some element of sustainability and local bar consumption based into the menu and what people eat in your restaurant. But it is, as you say, it is expensive, and to a large extent, it's unfortunately a bit elitist, but you know, that is what it is.
Well, in Europe, it's less so because the farms are always nearby.
Right. And here, if you go to the farmer's market, either here in the city, you know, when you pay $12 for a dozen carrots or, you know, $16 for 12 ramps, you know how expensive this local produce really can be.
It's never that high, Joe. At one point in your career, at what point in your career did you start thinking of yourself as Restaurant Man?
I think the restaurant man that I refer to really is my father. Mm-hmm. And the book is kind of the journey between when restaurants, when I grew up in the 70s, were really kind of a blue-collar immigrant's business, a business where people carved out a living, and it was, you know, the customer was royalty, and they were there to serve the customers, and it was a very different way of looking at what restaurants were.
And your parents owned a small red sauce restaurant in Queens, and mm-hmm. That was how you learned what it takes to run a restaurant. What did they serve at Buonavia?
It was called Buonavia, and it was in Forest Hills in Queens Boulevard. And they opened, I think, in 1970. And, you know, they started with a typical red sauce meal. And then I think that's kind of where my mom started cooking. And she got into the kitchen and made some of the dishes that she knew, maybe some gnocchi, some risotto, a guazzetto, stuffed peppers. And that's kind of how it began for them.
And how old were you when you started working in the restaurant?
I think that I was born working in the restaurant. So that restaurant opened when I was 2 years old, but really that's kind of where we spent our time.
And you said that your father ruined you from poultry because you accompanied him on his early morning runs to pick up that day's meat for the restaurant.
So there's various stories about going to the Hunts Point Market in the Bronx and Fulton Fish Market. You know, at that point in the mid-70s, the Bronx was literally and figuratively burning. And what you saw up there was, you know, as a young child, was very impressionable. And, you know, from vats of pig blood to hanging beef, it was much more of a raw kind of real place. And the bloody poultry chicken water was my job to sit in the back of the van and make sure all the stacks of chicken, which were packed in wood boxes back then with crushed ice, and then large pools of chicken blood would accumulate on 90 degrees days, you know, with 100% humidity, driving back into the city. You'd hit the FDR drive or the Bruckner, hit the brakes, and then it would be like a tsunami of bloody chicken water.
And even if it wasn't, the smell must have been overwhelming.
The smell of rancid chickens is one that will pry your memory for the rest of your life. You cannot get rid of it once you know what it smells like.
You said that you learned from your family that where you come from defines you. So do you identify most with Italian culture or, as your mother might say, Italian-American culture?
That's a good question. I mean, I definitely was born in this country. I feel American, but I think that because I've with this passion for food and wine and being able to go back there and make wine, I identify very much with that part of Italy and where my parents came from and the history of their people. And I've tried to really link into that in a real way.
Well, your last name is Croatian.
Right.
And I'm assuming a large portion of your family came from Yugoslavia. And there was a time when I was told almost all the good Italian restaurants in New York were from people who were from around the Trieste area.
And the fact is, I think when they left, it was prior to the war, it was Italy, and then it became Yugoslavia. And then the names, you know, if you go to the cemetery in the town where my father is, you'll see Bastiani, Bastianich with a J, C-H, though the names were changed for motivations of immigration and otherwise. So it's an interesting area from that perspective.
And you tell a funny story about bringing American guitars there when you went to visit.
Yeah, it was a little side business I had as a young teenager. I would bring authentic American, at that point, Fender Telecasters and Stratocasters over there and sell them in the very, very eager gray and black market to musicians in upcoming communist Yugoslavia who would handsomely pay me a profit enough to certainly fund beer and cigarette money for the summer.
And then they were going to sell again capitalism within a communist culture. But, well, you talk a lot about money in this book. It's central to the way that you evaluate a dining experience, and you give a basic rundown of restaurant math. Is that something your father passed on to you?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of in my DNA. I mean, just understanding how restaurants work. And I think that, if anything, the story of this book is a little bit of a behind the scenes into what makes a restaurant work, how does the money flow, who makes what in a restaurant, where does the money trickle down, and then in you as a customer, when you know that, it makes you a better restaurant customer, it makes you understand the business better.
You lay out a financial rule for restaurants. Your margins average out to 3 times the cost of everything. But sometimes, as I understand it, you can't charge 3 times, like if you're buying an expensive cut of beef. So what do? You increase the margins on lettuce or chicken?
Right. It's an average. So you say your food cost or cost of goods sold, basically 30%, 32%, 31%. Labor's another 30 and change, you know, and that leaves, you know, the 20% for rent, bug spray, everything else, and 20% on the bottom line. That's the way it used to be. I think people are willing to work for a lot less margin these days. In the old days, if you weren't making 20%, it was not good. Now I think people work for less.
But it's that also suggests that it's important to have a good relationship with your purveyors as with your customers.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the whole concept here is that in the restaurant business, more than any other industry, we acquire, we manufacture, we market, we do customer service. We kind of do it all. And everyone is trying to, you know, it's a battle at every step, you know, whether you're negotiating with a purveyor or with the landlord or the linen company. It's always about gathering nickels to make dollars. And I think that's the theme in the book, that the restaurant business seems like a business where you accumulate large amounts of money because you have a full restaurant, but it's really not that. The margins are small, you work hard, and you make dollars by saving nickels.
My guest is Joe Bastianich. His book, Restaurant Man, is published by Viking. Your parents opened a second restaurant in Queens called Villa Seconda.
Villa Seconda in Fresh Meadows on the Horace Harding Expressway.
The second place, actually.
The second place.
So was opening a restaurant in the early 80s as risky a business venture as it is now?
I think it was a huge venture for them because they left, you know, sold both restaurants in Queens, you know, wholesale, and bought a building on 58th Street, which was the then Restaurant Row. There was like 15 Italian restaurants on the block, and took a big step into, you know, selling authentic Italian food and really trying to recreate the real Italian dining experience, which was kind of the birth of that, really, at that time.
Well, I remember going to Italy and then coming back and saying, why can I get a meal like I got in Italy? It can't be that difficult. There had been a great Italian restaurant, at least it was considered great, in the 60s and 70s, Pariolo Romanissimo. Got 4 stars from the New York Times, and then nothing after that.
Mm-hmm.
Is it that difficult to make Italian food on the highest level?
I think that what happened in the late 70s and early 80s is overnight transport, Federal Express, things like that, that allowed ingredients to travel around the world, you know, buffalo mozzarella from Naples, and then just, you know, better olive oils, balsamic vinegar, arborio rice, and then the culture of people actually wanting to eat that cuisine. Because prior, you know, to 1980, there weren't that many places that were doing authentic Italian cuisine. You know, Da Silvano on 6th Avenue was probably the first real Tuscan trattoria in New York, and a couple of other people, but it was kind of a unplowed ground at that point.
But, and I imagine Pariola Romanissimo closed before you had an opportunity to eat there.
I never ate there that I can remember, but I think it probably closed in the late 70s or early 80s, yeah.
At 14, you began suggesting wines for customers at Validio. You weren't the sommelier, obviously, and you were under drinking age. Were you sipping the wines to taste them anyway?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we've always had a culture of sipping wine at the table ever since I was a kid. But at that point, it was running to the cellar. It was getting to know the bottles. At that point, my parents were collecting a massive wine cellar at home, so I spent my mornings unloading my dad's car from the night before, all the wine he would bring home, and bringing other wines that were aged back in his car so he could take them to the restaurant. So I knew the labels. I knew the wines. It was kind of an immersion.
Well, all of this sounds like the perfect preparation for opening up your own place, but you instead took a job on Wall Street. Were you trying to get away from the restaurant business?
You know, I think that, like, as my dad said, or any immigrant family, they wanted, you know, you want your kids to do better than you did. So for them, the restaurant business was a very tough, hardworking business, and that you should get an education like they didn't have and go out and have an important job, like be an accountant or a dentist, or, you know, do anything other than have to work in the restaurant, you know, 18 hours a day, 6.5 days a week. So that was kind of embedded with me. I was lucky enough to go to, you know, a prep school, Fordham Prep in the Bronx, and then Boston College. And in 1989, when I graduated, it seemed like that was the right thing to do.
So what led you to leave and go to Italy to learn about food and
wine?
You
know, it was an incredible experience, and but I decided that I needed to get back. Like, I think the restaurant man DNA in me kicked in, and I needed to get back to Italy and to really find myself, and I needed to get back where I was actually making something and producing something with my hands, something more physical labor, and that's kind of what drove me.
And you and your mother opened Becco.
We did. So I went to Italy, I lived there a year and a half, traveled around, lived in my car, made wine, worked in restaurants, came back here, and I knew I had to do something with restaurants.
And you were able to keep the price of a bottle of wine at only $15 and still keep the quality high. You couldn't do that anymore, could you?
Well, now the Becco still has 200 wines all at $25 a bottle. So It started off with all Italian wines, and then we added California, and it was $15 a bottle for every wine on the list. And those were more difficult times. In 1993, New York was in a bit of a slump, real estate recession. You know, there were things that – deals to be had around, and, you know, a sharp guy could go out there and buy wine and make deals. And
but is wine – wine and drinks in general, alcohol what allows a restaurant to succeed even if some of the food costs go up?
I think that's a big misnomer. I think in a lot of restaurants, especially our restaurants, we really try to keep the margin down on wines and give people quality wines and a quality wine drinking experience, because it's just – it's part of the meal. You know, for us, wine on the table is like food, and there's no way we would make you overpay for it.
And then your mother introduced you to Mario Batali.
She did. She was doing a James Beard journalism dinner, and she wanted to bring the young Italians. And Mario had been in Italy himself, opened up a little restaurant. I had my restaurant. I'd never really met him. We worked together on that, and we became friends.
And he was already establishing himself as a exactly the celebrity chef that he's
right.
become.
He had a little trattoria on Cornelia Street called Poe. Mm-hmm. It was doing very well. It was very small.
It's still around, even though he doesn't own it anymore.
He doesn't own it anymore. And I had Becco in the theater district. My restaurant was slightly more square, unhip, and he had the more cool West Village place.
Well, we've heard of a lot of people who hit it off right away, and then as they get more and more involved with business, things get rough. Are you just lucky that you've become successful business partners?
I think we have a good relationship. We were friends before we ever decided to open a restaurant together, which happened quite by accident. And I think that we both – I think Mario, as a chef, has a sensibility of also wanting to create margin and not art at the cost of margin, and this sensibility of a businessman and a reasonableness about how he cooks and how he thinks about food. And we share that in common. And we were both very – great admirers of my father because of that kind of very nuts and bolts sensibility.
Well, he also comes out of the food business. His father had a salumeria, didn't
Still
he?
Still does.
So you opened Babbo together.
We opened Babbo.
And it was an immediate success.
It was. Babo kind of was an important restaurant in New York. We were lucky to be a part of it. It was in the ex-Coach House building on Waverly Place. And, yeah, Babo kind of was our purest expression of what, at that point, we thought the sensibility of Italian hospitality and cuisine and wine was really about. And we were uncompromising in how we executed it at Babo. And it was really just about making a statement about what we thought at that point.
Well, he was Mario was experimenting to some degree. He wasn't just sticking to the classic Italian dishes.
I think that the philosophy of Babo in a lot of ways is to bring, not to exactly duplicate what you might eat in Italy, but bring the sensibility and intellect of Italian dining from the Italian table and interpret it in New York, maybe using the best of local produce and local bounty, fish or whatever, with the right Italian condiments to create this new, smarter Italian cuisine that was really about the intellectualism of Italian eating.
Last October, Gothamist reported that many West Village residents were complaining about the limos that queued up outside of Babo. I guess success also brings some problems.
Which is just one of the details that we try to manage. We're very sorry for...
In L.A., you would have had valet parking.
Right.
But Del Posto is in an area that's easier to park in.
Yes.
You opened that a couple of years, some years ago. And then in 2010, it became the first Italian restaurant since Pariola Romanissimo to get 4 stars from the New York Times. But it's interesting. You had more Michelin stars. You lost a Michelin star, and you gained a star from the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think was going on there?
I think it's a restaurant in evolution. I think that for us, interpreting the Italian dining experience at the highest level, as the French, you know, are able to do it, was something of a journey. It didn't happen immediately. It took some time to get there.
Well, you got to convince people that they should be willing to spend the kind of money they spend at a top level French restaurant.
But I think that whereas the French have this incredible culture of the cuisine of kings and noble courts, the Italian cuisine is really a cuisine of grandmothers and mothers and towns and simple food. So I think creating 4-star Italian dining experience is kind of an unwritten script, and we really had a look into our own cultures, and my mom was involved with us, and really what comes together. We didn't even have the terminology. You know, there's no amuse-bouche. We tried not to use the French words, you know, and we had to kind of reinvent it and make it up as we went along to create this Italian experience that didn't really have a lot of history behind it.
Haven't you and Mario both lost a lot of weight in recent years?
I think, yeah. I certainly have.
What have you done? Does Italian – because in Italy you don't see a lot of fat people.
It's true. I think it's about sensibility as a portion control, you know, protein sizes are smaller. Me personally, I started running marathons and most recently have become a competitive triathlete. I just competed in Kona World Championship Triathlon, Ironman.
Joe Bastianich opened his first restaurant, Becco, with his mother, Lydia Bastianich, in 1993, and he and his partner, Mario Batali, have since established some of New York's most celebrated restaurants, including Babo, Del Posto, Lupa, Esca, and Otto Enoteca Pizzeria. He's written a book called Restaurant Man, which is published by Viking. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.